Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello. You may have heard there's a bike race coming up soon in France. As we record this, the 2018 Tour de France is nearly with us, just the small matter of some football to get out of the way first. One of the most distinctive writers on cycling, and the Tour in particular, is the French poet, author and journalist Paul Fournel. His books, Need for the Bike and Anquetil Alone, have been published in English, and many of his articles have appeared in Ruleur magazine. His love of cycling and his fascination with the legend of Jacques Anquetil began at a very early age.
In fact, my father was a cyclist. He was not a racer at all, but he was a cyclist. And so I've heard about cycling since my very, very childhood, very beginning, maybe two years old or 1 year old. I don't remember. And I started to ride when I was nine, and I started to love Jacques Anquetil at that time, at the same time.
What was it about Anquetil, amongst all the other great French riders of the time, all the great international riders of the time, that really appealed to the young you?
You know, I was absolutely unable to analyze why I loved him, because I was much too young. But I wanted to be him. I wanted to look like him. And, of course, we had quite a difference. He was tall, blonde, lean, and I was short. I was dark and was big. And so that was not exactly the good story. But I loved him because I guess that the first thing is that he was so beautiful on the bicycle. Oh, I've never seen that. You know, at that time, there was no wind tunnel. There was nothing of that kind. And it was all by instinct. And he was so beautiful. He was pedaling like no one else. And so I think this is the reason why, as a little boy who wanted to be a cyclist, I was fascinated by him.
But he wasn't universally popular in France at all, was
Oh,
he?
No, not at all. Not at all. The popular guy was Raymond Poulidor, of course, who was exactly the French peasant from Massif Central, huge shoulders, broad shoulders, strong guy, and very willing and very nice at the same time. And so people loved him. And on top of everything, he was losing, so which made him even more sympathetic than he was.
But we always think that, you know, loving the loser and the underdog is a British thing, but it's a French trait.
It can
as
happen
well.
In France too. Yes, in that case, it happened. And he had nothing of the elegance of Jacques Anquetil, of course. But he was very popular. And Jacques Anquetil was popular too, but not as much as Raymond Poulidor.
British people, I think, always regard Anquetil as the sort of quintessential French cyclist. There was a, you know, he reflected to our view a lot of the characteristics of the French nation. But yes. So it's surprising he wasn't sort of
that's
taken
true.
More to the nation's
that's
heart.
True. That's true, but he wasn't, I must say, on the elegant side of France, if there is one, I don't know. But if there is one, he was on that side, a little aristocratic. And there's the other side of France, which is the deeply rooted into the countryside and the Massif Central and the climbs and everything. And Jacques Anquetil was on the other side. 50 years before, he was people, as we say in French now. He was people. So he loved beautiful cars, he loved beautiful clothes, beautiful women, and he was always... kind of showing off, and it was always in the magazine Paris Match, and Paris Match was the magazine with the photos and with all the stars, and he was a star.
We'll talk a little bit about Anquetil alone, your book, in a second. Right at the end, you sort of refer to his personal life, which, to put it mildly, was complex, right at the end of the book. Is his complicated personal life still a huge issue in France, or do people just shrug it off?
For a very long time, this life was kept secret. And the one to open the door was his daughter when she wrote a book. But it was later and later on. Anquetil was dead for a long time. And so, but she was the one to tell the story. And the story was that he had a baby with the daughter of his wife. And the story goes on, and then he married the wife of the son of his wife, and so on and so on. And so it's quite a strange strange life, a strange personal life. I must say that at the time, we didn't know about that. There was always the mythic couple, Jacques and Jeannine Anquetil. They were, and everywhere on magazines, and she was always with him. And so this was kind of a very huge love, official, popular, huge love. And then, when he was, when he started to be a gentleman farmer after the race time, and he wanted to have a baby. And so they had that incredible idea to, Jeannine was unable to have babies anymore. And so he had that incredible idea to have a baby with Jeannine's daughter that he had raised.
And so, they then entered into a relationship.
Yes, absolutely. And so that was quite
It's always
surprising.
Struck me that Christmas at the Anquetils must have been quite quite tense.
Yeah, there was a war. Of course, they lived all together during about 15 years. But then there was a clash between the girls. And, of course, Anquetil was losing it. And... that was impossible. That was simply impossible. And so they left.
When you set out to write your book, I was going to call it a biography, but it's not sort of, not a conventional biography.
No, not at all. Not at all. I was, when I started to write the book, it was 50 years after the facts. And I was just wondering why. I wanted to answer the question. Why was I so attracted to him, and why? What was the mystery of that? Because, when you're a little boy, you do not know why you do things and why you love things. You know, for example, when Eddy Merckx was at his best, I was 15, I was 19, I was 20. So I had explanations. I knew because, I knew he was winning, he was strong, he was doing this, he was doing that. So I was able to analyze my my interests into him and others. But Jacques Anquetil, I was much younger than that, and I wanted to explore this kind of love, this kind of attraction that I had for him. That was it.
It's always struck me that cycling, more than... possibly any other sport other than boxing, has always attracted some interesting writing.
Yeah, that's quite understandable. First thing, cycling race, the Tour de France, was made to first place to sell a newspaper. So the link with writing and with reading is very strong at the very beginning. Then if you think about what Tour de France or Giro is, it's nothing but a feuilleton. You know, it's literature, because you have the bad guys, you have the good guys, and then, you know, you have someone losing something on one day and getting it back on the following day. There's kind of a, you know, kind of a mystery going on. And so this is a very strong link with literature. You can tell a story, you know, and you can tell the story of the race in very different ways. I remember when I was a kid, when I was in, 15, maybe 16, I was reading L'Équipe every day. And this was for me the best school to understand what style is. Because at the same time, there was the paper by Chani. And Chani was, you know, the top, top journalist. And he was writing the race at the beginning, at the middle, at an end. There were events. Everything was absolutely scrupulously detailed, and that was nice. And so, you know, it was so nice that when people ask Anquetil what happened today, he said, ask Chani. Chani was the one to know. And, you know, on the same page, you had the paper by Jacques Godet, who was the boss of the Tour de France, and he was into big lyricism. This was, you know, wow, the top mountains and going down deep and, you know, big guys and so and so. And then you had the third one, which was Antoine Blondin. And Antoine Blondin was more on the cultural side, the literary side, funny side of the race, and always picking up the small detail that makes a difference. And so, you know, there are so many different ways of telling the story of the race, that it's literature. Cycling is literature. And on top of that, you have the time. You have time. It's long. It takes time. You know, the Tour de France takes 21 days. And it's more difficult, apart from boxing, but boxing, I think that writers are fascinated by what's around boxing. You know, the bad guys and this strange stories and those boxers that are coming from nowhere and getting punched in their faces. And so, you know, there is something violent in it. It's more like noir literature. And but cycling is more like feuilleton, like stories, and that works. And that has always been the case.
And, of course, for much of the history of cycling, and in particular the Tour de France, a lot of the stories were almost fiction themselves, weren't they?
Yeah, of course.
Many of the stories that we know and love about the Tour were made up by writers.
Yeah. And so this is a... and, you know, on top of the race itself, you have a lot of things going on in the background. You know, and people like that, in fact. People like those doping stories and those, 1988 and 1998 and 1996 and so and so. And they all remember those things that are the story under the story. I know about that. And so this is a mystery.
To what extent does the fact that France hasn't had a winner of the Tour since...
Eno.
What effect does that have on the French psyche?
Things have been changing so much and so fast. You know, at the very beginning of Tour de France, there were guys from Belgium, there were some Italians, Spanish, and French. That was it. Maybe some guys from Holland from time to time. That was it. And so now you have guys coming from everywhere in the world. Not only American, but English people, and also guys coming from Middle Europa and all those guys. So it's quite legitimate that we do not have a big French champ these days. But I think it will come back at some point. I'm not very interested in seeing French guys win. I like the race for the race, and if the English one is good, I'm happy. I'm happy. So, but of course, we are expecting a big champion. We have been waiting for more than 20 years now, and 30 years, And we expect always, one day it's Alaphilippe, you know, the other day we say, oh, maybe this one, maybe there's one. But for time being, there's no French, no, there are very good French racers, but there's not a winner. We do not have a winner. You have a lot of winners here in England, potential winners, and they are, that's good. So you had the Wiggins years and Froome years, and maybe more to come, I don't know. But it's good, I like that.
Tell us a bit about your latest book, Les Cartes du Tour.
Yeah, so this is a book which is a comfortable book. It's a book with pictures. And those pictures are all the maps of the Tour de France from 1903 up to now. And for every year, Guy Andrews and Taz Darling, who are the publishers of the book, have found maps coming from everywhere in the world, different shapes, different colors, different, you know, some are from children's book, others are the official maps of the Tour de France, others are from L'Equipe, others are from, you know, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, and so and so. And I try to tell the story of the maps. I try to tell a story which is, of course, the story. It's a small story. It's the story of the maps. But at the same time, big picture is the story of France. You know, new roads that are opening in the mountains, new ways of, you know, of traveling. You know, the first trains, TGV, planes, everything. And so it tells a lot about the history of France as well, and the geography of France. And it tells also a lot about the history of cycling itself, because the rules have changed. At the beginning, the maps of the Tour was touring exactly France, even touring more than France, because there was always a stage in Metz, which was German at the time, so that was a big fight every year. But that's the story. So this is a history of this. And then the rules have changed years after years. Now, at the beginning, they had, you know, 350 kilometers per stage. They were starting during the night. They were pedaling all night and all day long. Then they had couple of days rest and the following one. And so now there are rules. You cannot have too long a stage. You can have too short ones. You have to do this or that kind of call in the Alps. You cannot do more than four or five calls in the day, 5,000 meters or whatever. And so there are rules like this. And so this is the story of the race at the same time.
And what are your thoughts about 2018? Are you looking forward to the 2018 tour?
It's a strange one. Map-wise, it's a strange one, because you have they have to take two planes, which is quite strange. So there's a first diagonal going from Brittany to north of maybe Alsace or something like that. And then you have a second diagonal going from Annecy to Biarritz, which is quite surprising. And then they have to take a plane to go back to Paris and to finish on the Champs-Élysées. So it's one of the most bizarre map of the history of Tour de France. And there is also another detail. If you check on the map, you will see that you arrive someplace in a city, but they leave from another one in the morning, the following morning, not very far from the first one. So means maybe that there's not enough money to pay for both arrival and departure, maybe, I don't know. But because it costs money, of course. They have to pay, you know, the cities have to pay. It can pay back. They pay a lot of money, but it's not huge, huge money. But that can pay back. Remember, 1975, for the first time, there was a stage coming in that little ski resort of the south of Alps, known as Praloux. And this is where the huge, you know, Eddy Merckx himself was beaten by Thévenet, and all of a sudden Pralou was known worldwide. This little city was all of a sudden, you know, more notorious than Val d'Isère or Courchevel. So it was quite interesting. That can bring some good to some of those cities. Others are ritual cities, and every year you have something, maybe Bordeaux, Saint-Étienne. So those are the habitual suspects, usual suspects.
Paul Fournel and Anquetil Alone is published by Pursuit Books, and Les Cartes du Tour will be out in July, published by Raffa.
The peloton as a whole doesn't want the racing start immediately. If it does, it makes the race harder. Team leaders trying to intimidate everybody.
No change back here, Charlie. Just some serious blocking going on.
Some of the fascinating middle of the peloton footage from the new film Time Trial. It's a look at life as a pro cyclist, centering on David Miller's last professional season. Although, like Paul Fournel's book on Anquetil, it's far from your standard bike biography. For director Finlay Pretzel, it's been a long journey.
I feel like the film's actually always been in the back of my mind, you know? So, officially, maybe it's 10 years from start to finish in a way, but I feel like just recently I've been thinking it's actually been there for a lot longer than that. As a bike racer or fanatic, I suppose it's always been just gestating in a way.
So was the idea always to kind of make a film about bike racing rather than a specific story?
Yeah, no, it was always about not the big champions in the sport, somebody who's a very good rider, but not out front, the big names, the Lance Armstrongs, the Wiggins, the Froomes. It was about what goes on behind all of that. But it was always about bike racing. It was never about a specific person or story.
And when you tried to raise money for it, when you tried to talk to, you know, other people about getting the film made, how difficult was that?
Incredibly difficult, I think. And I think because it's a documentary, and B, ambitious in what it was trying to achieve, I think. It's my first feature-length film, so that's also a difficulty. But it becomes... I think what you fast realise is there's lots of cycling fans out there. We kind of raised some private investment for the film, quite a lot, actually. And we thought that would be the route to go. There's lots of cycling aficionados, film people, but you're making a film on an idea. You're asking them to give money to an idea. It's not there's no script, there's no stars attached, apart from David Miller, but apart from that, it becomes very difficult. I mean, stars as in star actors. I think that's the way these things usually work. So, yeah, it was a long road to do that, I think. But the more and more people you talk to, it has been 10 years that it's been on the go. But most of these films take 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you know, if not beyond.
Where did the connection with David Miller come about? When did you decide he was going to be the centrepiece of the film?
I made a film called Standing Start in 2006, and a lot of it was shot at these Revolution events, the track events in Manchester.
It was based on Craig McLean.
Craig McLean, yeah. So it was based there. Fran Miller was part of the company who, you know, organised these events. And I saw David. He was in the crowd, or he kind of came out, did a few laps at the velodrome for some reason. And I was suddenly reminded, or struck by his presence again. You kind of notice him, this big, tall, handsome, well-groomed looking guy. He was riding for Sonia Duval at the time. And I'd suddenly thought, maybe it's him. It was a very just fleeting thought, I think, and then he appears like for a microsecond in that film. And then roll on a year or two after we'd finished the film, and I'd made sure he got the film back from Fran. And I arranged a meeting together at the Braveheart cycling dinner in Scotland where he was coming. And we sat and talked and stayed up all night talking about how this could work. And I think the thing with David, he was up for that collaboration, and he was up for saying, yeah, let's just do this and capture this experience. And so he was very much on board with it, you know, and I think that's essential, that someone's got the kind of the foresight to see that this could be something bigger and something that will last and not just a kind of quick fix documentary in a way. So,
and how were the sort of cycling authorities, you know, the people who run the races, the people who run the teams, how helpful and sympathetic were they in getting the film made?
Well, you can imagine, I think, how difficult it was, really. From everything, I mean, David would constantly help us with that access, you know, because we ended up shooting a lot with RCS, you know, the people that organised the Giro and Milan San Remo. And so we shot a lot, most of the footage is from Tirreno Adriatico and Milano San Remo.
Was that because the people who run the tour were slightly less helpful?
Yeah, but, well, I had a meeting when we were kind of researching. I had a meeting with Christian Prudhomme, and we kind of just floated the idea of potentially shooting it at the Tour de France. And it just fast, like, just within those minutes. And they realised it's not going to be possible. But also, I wouldn't have wanted to do it there. It was never that idea. I think it was always about this preparation and getting to the Tour de France that I enjoyed the idea of this kind of... The Tour de France is a special, unique, one-off event that happens every year that, you know, everyone knows about. But all these other races are these... They're much more interesting and much more vibrant. And I kind of thought we could potentially get better access for these ones. And for certainly the way I wanted to shoot this thing, it's like... I didn't want to just be like... one of a million cameras and a million microphones trying to grab stuff, you know, and I really wanted to, you know, take the time to construct scenes and, you know, really be careful about how we shot it. But
because the sort of core of the film is a lot of the on-bike footage shot during races. Tell us how you went about that. What was the technology involved there?
I think the biggest thing for us was this bespoke motorbike that we constructed with these guys in France. That was the key thing for capturing these kind of, you know, the time trial scene and everything that's on the bike, this motorbike was captured. So that took a long time to construct. It's a really awkward bike with the Martin Radic, the DOP, sitting backwards, you know, a lot of the time. And no, that's not conventional. It's quite difficult to maneuver, and it's a real big construction on the back of this bike. And so that was the big thing for us. And then the other things we were the first kind of UCI test project to use onboard cameras, and now they're everywhere, of course. But we had these fantastic tiny little lipstick cameras that we could just put anywhere, and they're really discreet, so you don't ever notice them. And I really like them. I think it's funny with all these GoPros now, they're like 4K and all big resolution. But for me, I really liked when these lipstick cameras were really basic, way before what we had them as, because they gave this real kind of jagged digital look, which I loved. You know, it kind of, you felt the bike, because we did these tests like years before just on our own. And I loved that kind of energy it gave. And rolling forward, the cameras are still good, but and all the footage in the film is actually like all ours, more or less. And even the kind of glitchy, kind of like chaotic stuff that happens towards the end is, it's all ours. It's all in camera. Sometimes some water would get into the camera, especially in like Milan San Remo. But yeah, amazing little cameras actually.
Not feeling good, Charles.
Just do what you can. Think hard on everyone, David. There was people getting dropped on the Turquina.
Stay motivated. If you stay in the front, you got to be good. Stay in the front, guys. Come on, stay motivated. Everybody's hurting. Get up there, guys. Come on.
It's a very personal story of David Miller's last season, effectively, and all the ups and downs of that. And David is, throughout it, is very honest and open. Was that a difficult thing to film?
Yeah, it was. David has a front, and he's quite difficult to penetrate, you know. And he, but I knew he was always willing to go there. It's just because we did hours of interviews, not that many hours, really. I mean, we just sat down for these kind of quite long 2-3 hour interviews over the kind of course from 2011, I think, and another one in the middle of that, and then 2015, for instance. It's a difficult barrier to get over with him, definitely, because he's so used to speaking, giving sound bites, and he's very aware of how he comes across and aware of this, how he speaks and what he says and each word that comes out of his mouth. So it is incredibly difficult to kind of get through that. But I think by the time we kind of shot that last interview, it became, we were just like, oh, come on, we were both, I think, quite tired of making the film in a way. Even though I think David would keep going, he would keep, if I keep asked him again or I pushed it, he would be quite open to do it. And fair play to him. I think that's credit to him for that. But I think, yeah, really quite difficult. I can't say any more, really. I think because he's so aware of this, how he is and how he comes across. And
but there are a couple of bits where, you know, the emotion of the whole thing really do come across, yeah, and they make the film.
Absolutely. And there's a moment where he gets angry with me, which I think for me is the most, it's so honest and straightforward. And he could have given me an answer. He could have said, yeah, this is the way it was, and that's the way I did
this. Is the section about his return from, yeah, a drugs ban.
Exactly. And he just refused to talk to me about it. And for me, that was, I was excited when he got angry, you know, because it's an emotion, and he's, you know, he is sick of talking, and I can fully understand that, you know, I can really appreciate it.
Now, the one thing that in the previews has attracted a lot of attention is the ending.
Mm.
Without giving away what happens in the end, how did that come about? What was the thought process that led you to end the film in that way?
Well, this was a scene I'd wanted to shoot right at the start. I really had always had this in my mind. I could never work out when we're actually going to do it, because it wasn't, we would have to set it up. And I think I think that captures not only David and how he deals with things and how I'm trying to think of a word to say, like how he lets go and lets rip. And I don't think it's just him that does that. I think any athlete, any person can appreciate that, and they can go for it at that level. And it's no different if you're a professional cyclist or you work in a bar. It's the same idea. And I think for me, I wanted this kind of abandon. I wanted just to be like, like the shackles are off and I can enjoy life again, you know. And I think it's this idea of this, I suppose the film's almost like a bit of a nightmare, but it was a dream at first, this dream idea, and then it became a nightmare, and he wanted out of it again by the end, you know.
And Finlay Pretzel's Time Trial is in UK cinemas from the end of June. Now, Stuart Clapp, editor of Ruleur's Desire section, you said, if you don't like the ending of Time Trial, we can't be friends, or something like that. Do you still stand by that?
Yeah, I still stand by that. I think I said it was a barrier to our friendship. Yeah, I love that film. I think it's really good. And not just because I'm a David Miller fanboy, but I think that era of that Garmin team was quite special that he was at. I think it gives you a rare insight into what goes on behind the race. You know, there's a bit in it where David Miller can't find his gloves and things like this, and you see the things that aren't so silky smooth and organised, and this, you know, someone's going through his kit bag and can't find gloves and can't get a jacket on and off. And I really like the ending as well, which I know that it's been, it's a bit like Marmite. Some people have got it. David Miller's wife hasn't. I want people to come back to me afterwards and say, I got the ending too. And then we'll be friends. We'll Facebook message each other. We could hang out. But if you don't, then I don't know. I don't know if we would have been friends at school.
Speaking of David Miller, he's in the magazine quite soon.
He is. Yeah, we've used David Miller for issue 18.5. I'm just trying to, because we're working in advance, so I never remember which issue it is. 18.5. So it's the next one that comes out. David Miller's modelling his new Chapter 3 Girona kit, and he's got his Factor bikes in there. He's a bit of a collection. Went out, I suppose, when was that? 2 weeks ago? Went out and shot it, and Christian Mayer's in it as well. So it's I don't know, I think we've peaked. I don't know how we're going to follow it now. I've just seen the drafts of the Desire pages, and I actually want to buy everything that's in there. There's a particularly cool bike. It's a time trial bike, that's at the service course, because Christian Mayer owns the service course in Girona. It's a lovely bike shop. And there was a TT bike that he had on his Instagram feed, and I was, we have to have it. The shoot looks fantastic. I don't really. I don't know what I'm gonna do for the issue after.
Tour de France coming up. Do you have any Tour de France memories you can share with us?
I've got a few. I don't know which ones I'm allowed to say in public, but I did have a really funny night out once. Remember when they went up Alpe d'Huez twice? It was the year Froome won. I think it was 2013. Anyway, we went out, and it was wall to wall, this place. This is the beauty of cycling, I always find. Top of Alpe d'Huez, you've got every nationality under the sun in there. It's like everyone's getting, you know, on the dance floor. Everyone's mostly blokes as well, mostly blokes. At one point, I turned around and my friend had two twins from Luxembourg, two lads, under each arm, and they were on a podium together. So through the evening, you're walking around the club and like, it's Robbie McEwen. Anyway, so I happened to run into one of Lance's old domestiques in there, who I've been drunk before, but I've never been this drunk. He was completely, completely out of it. He couldn't talk, he couldn't walk. So I carried him out with a PR from Garmin. And we were like, right, okay, we worked out where he would have been staying. So we thought, we've got to get him out of the club before he gets thrown out or throws up. And so I had him over one shoulder and over the other. And he was fast asleep. And you carry someone who's fast asleep, and it is like a dead weight. You can't move him, even though there's nothing of him. But the only way I could get him to wake up was by shouting, quick, Landis has attacked. And he woke up and his legs started moving again.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.